Here on Radio 4 FM, Julian Barrett reads a new biography of Leonard Cohen, an artist whose music has provoked and inspired every generation from the 1960s to the present day. A Broken Hallelujah by Lil Liebowitz begins in Leonard's childhood with a significant bereavement. Extracts from personal papers and diaries are read by Colin Stinton.
There's a song called The Story of Isaac, and it's about those who would sacrifice one generation on behalf of another. Well, the door had opened slowly. My father, he came in. I was 9 years old.
Life, as Leonard Norman Cohen knew it, ended on January the 14th, 1944.
And his voice was very cold.
The day his father died. That morning, he and his sister Esther walked past the dead man's coffin, taking one last look at his alabaster face. It was Esther's birthday, and when they returned home, Leonard, now the man of the house, told his sister that a celebration was in order. A birthday was a birthday, and there was protocol to be followed. For a moment they tried to be happy, but every thought led them back to the funeral home. They started sobbing. Esther was 14, Leonard was 9. Everything about the mourning rites of adults seemed designed to help the bereaved ease into the future. But Leonard wanted a few more moments with the past. One night, he sneaked into his father's room and selected his favourite bow tie. With a pair of scissors, he cut a slit in the fabric, then scribbled a few words on a slip of paper and inserted it into the tie. Quietly, he walked down the great staircase and opened the front door of the house. He tiptoed his way to the backyard, which looked out onto King George Park in Westmount, Montreal. With the tall locust trees as his dark and silent witnesses, Leonard dug into the earth, tossed the tie into the hole, and covered it with dirt.
It was the first thing I wrote. I've been digging in the garden for years, looking for it. Maybe that's all I'm doing, looking for the note.
Like other wealthy Jewish families in Montreal, the Cohens lived on top of the hill in Westmount, having climbed their way up from humble beginnings in the foundries and factories and sweatshops downtown. But Leonard's father, Nathan, stood apart from his siblings. His body had been shattered in the First World War, and those afflictions slowly killed him over the course of years. In the meantime, he grudgingly took his place in the family's back row, while his brothers enjoyed their wealth and lived their lives in the front office of the factory and the front seats of the synagogue. Nathan was overseeing machines and wheezing on the production floor.
The persecuted brother, the near poet, the innocent of machine toys, the sighing judge who listens but does not sentence.
It was from his father's position on the totem pole that the teenage Leonard was invited to join the family enterprise. It was expected of him. But a summer spent hanging coats in the factory confirmed that while there was a place for him, it was far from the center, and it offered little that appealed to a young man who was growing up and discovering the likes of Byron and Blake. Leonard was expected to adopt the polite theology and dispassionate approach to life that was all the rage at the Cohen's conservative synagogue at the top of the hill. And there was another influence working on him. Several years after his father's death, Leonard's maternal grandfather, Rabbi Solomon Klinitsky Klein, moved in for a while. He was a celebrated scholar who would read to his grandson from the prophets, like Isaiah, who wrote about how the Lord shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. These Hebrew prophets felt the need to abandon reason and revel in the mysterious and the ecstatic and the obscure. They shouted, they trembled, they felt with all their hearts. They were poets. Through the prophets, Leonard's grandfather gave him the gift of an alternative and far more stirring vision of Jewish life. And so, it was on the cusp of the old and the new, between ancient texts and modern buildings, that Leonard Cohen grew up. But what was an adolescent to do with such insight? His father dead, his mother gnawed by grief and anxiety, his own future unclear. The only way to quiet the chorus of demons that rattled Cohen with emotions too great for him to handle was to engage in the teenage tradition of excessive distraction. He ran for student government, mastered public speaking, learned to play a host of instruments passably, rode his bicycle, played sports, toyed with hypnosis, pursued women. Observed from afar, Cohen gave off such an affable and adroit air that some of those who knew him could be forgiven for thinking, as they did, that he had willed himself into erasing whatever traumatic marks his father's passing might have left on his psyche, and emerged a new and whole man. He did no such thing. At home, he would spend most of his time locked in his room, hiding and reading. And he developed a lifelong habit of nighttime wandering, setting out on hours-long excursions that led him to the gritty parts of town that most of his fellow young Westmount Jews had no idea existed. It was freedom, but it came at a cost.
I don't know what it was that drove me downtown two or three nights a week. There were often long, dark blocks between the windows I loved. Walking them, hungry for the next array, I had a heroic vision of myself. I was a man in the mid-20s, raincoated, battered hat pulled low above intense eyes, a history of injustice in his heart, a face too noble for revenge, walking the night along some wet boulevard, followed by the sympathy of countless audiences.
Leonard Cohen had to find his own way, and he found poetry. In later years, he was repeatedly asked for the story of how he started out, and repeatedly gave contradictory, often playful answers. Sometimes he would claim to have been sitting on a deck and basking in the sun when, out of nowhere, a poem struck him like a ray and announced to him his destiny as a conduit for divine inspiration. Other times he would take a more earthly tone and say he only started writing to get girls.
I wanted them and I couldn't have them. That's really how I started writing poetry. I wrote notes to women so as to have them. They began to show them around, and soon people started calling it poetry. When it didn't work with women, I appealed to God.
But while he remained coy about the poetry he wrote, Cohen was much more forthcoming about the poetry he read. When he was 15, he took one of his ambles and ended up in a used bookshop, where he stumbled upon a book of poetry by Federico García Lorca. Cohen realized right away that Lorca's central artistic engine was also his own. It was the Duende. The term is hard to translate. It is frequently referred to as deep song, and often just as soul. But Duende wasn't just for musicians. It was also the dowry of poets. In Lorca, Cohen glimpsed his own state of mind, reflected back at him in beautiful verse, rich with intricate imagery, elegant and gloomy. With Lorca by his side, Cohen was ready to try his own hand at writing poetry. On the cover of one early notebook, he scribbled,
"Poems written while dying of love."
Leonard entered Montreal's McGill University in 1951. Here he may have written poetry, but he wasn't ready to appoint himself a member of the same club as Lorca and the others he admired. In his junior year, as the newly elected president of the debate club, he travelled with his friends to the Norfolk Penitentiary outside Boston to attend a debate. He had already published some of his writing in school publications, and someone introduced him as a poet. When he took the podium, he denied the allegation.
"My colleague has promised you a poet, but I'm afraid that you will be disappointed. I do not converse in rhyming couplets, nor do I wear a cape, or walk brooding over the moor, or drink wine from a polished human skull, or stride frequently into the cosmic night."
Still, he wrote poetry. His first collection was published in 1956, a few months after his graduation. It was called Let Us Compare Mythologies. In it, Cohen conjured otherworldly images, biblical references, spiritual currents. But these images all came crashing down onto the streets of 1950s Montreal, and the sacred became all the more startling when viewed against the backdrop of the profane.
"Now the hollow nests, sit like tumors or petrified blossoms between the wire branches.
He wrote in The Sparrows.
And you, an innocent scientist, question me on these brown sparrows, whether we should plant our yards with breadcrumbs or mark them with the black persistent crows whom we hate and stone.
The poem went on to win a literary contest sponsored by the university's student newspaper, and Cohen went on to become the campus's reigning literary talent. But Cohen's journal from the same period reveals a young man not content with this first taste of success, but one plagued by melancholy. He wrote bluntly about his aimless nocturnal walks down to the strip clubs of St. Catherine Street, and about what went through his mind concerning life in his mother's house.
Sometimes when I got home, my mother would be on the telephone describing my coat to the police. As I prepared for bed, she'd rage outside my closed door demanding explanations, calling on my dead father to witness my delinquency, calling on God to witness her ordeal and having to be both a father and a mother to me. I would fall asleep in the torrent, thinking usually of the exhausted school day that awaited me.
It was too much to take. He tried several remedies. He spent a semester in law school. He spent some months working for his uncles. He drove down to New York, rented an apartment on Riverside Drive, and enrolled at Columbia, studying English and continuing his writing. But none of these occupations felt right. The routines of work or of graduate school could not curb his sense that there was a better way of being that he simply hadn't discovered yet. His eventual answer was simple, but inspired. He would entertain, but deliver the sort of punchlines that carried a real, an existential punch. To achieve that, he needed to create a public persona, and so he became the poet. In the strip clubs and the jazz joints and the oily eateries of St. Catherine Street, Leonard Cohen was reborn. He gave midnight readings, sitting on a stool, softly illuminated by a spotlight, and accompanied by a 6-piece band. He was there to entertain. In the late 50s and early 60s, to be hip, you had to be a little bit lost, and Cohen innovated. He frequently enthralled audiences with quips and jokes. He gave outrageous performances on TV and took the spotlight in seedy clubs. To the suited adults who now paid him around $100 per television appearance, the poet was skillfully walking the line between genuine artist and smirking conman. But Cohen was never lost in the funhouse. Jokes, he realized, and televised spectacles were the only language his generation spoke fluently. What they wanted was for their idols to be cool, and Cohen knew just how to deliver.
You who build these altars now to sacrifice our children, you must not do it anymore.
His performance pieces were like cluster bombs. They dropped fast, penetrated deeply, and set off a series of ongoing explosions that resonated long after they were first heard. In the years of being the poet, Cohen's aim had grown accurate. What he needed now was a more focused target.
Julian Barrett was reading from A Broken Hallelujah by Lil Leibowitz, with Colin Stinton as the voice of Leonard Cohen. The producer was Pippa Vaughan, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Well, the news is next, and then afterwards, one of the guests on Woman's Hour this morning will be the daughter of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and poor Tutu talks to Jane Garvey in a couple of minutes. Then, at 10:45, we'll be doing some maths.
3 into 2 won't go.
Edith doesn't love you.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, she married you, it's true, but no one, including Edith, can quite understand why.
But losing the one can prove difficult.
Very well, then. I'm coming too.
No!
No! Dilly and I are going out, and we're not telling you where.
Further absurd romantic entanglements based on the novels by Ada Leveson. The Little Otleys returns to BBC Radio 4 throughout this week, starting today at 10:45 in the morning.